me get things all set up. I'm going to turn that volume off.
It's kind of funny, so double fisting a microphone and a soda, because I keep thinking I'm drinking out of this hand. Talking into this one and like drinking out of this one.
You're like, hang on, let me.
Or just like dump soda down my front.
I'm really curious what that's going to sound like when I go back to edit everything.
It's always spooky.
At the very beginning of the last episode, it says, I'm going to be so mad when I go through and like get to the part where your microphone died, but I'm going to be really holding out for the section that we talk about in Art the Clown Hole Tat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Here we are hoping. Hoping and praying.
I'm Clark.
Oh, I'm Karina.
And this is It's Always Spooky. So this week, we're going to be talking about... both the book and the movie of The Mist by Stephen King. And then I don't know who the director is.
It's Frank Darabont for the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. He also directed the first season of The Walking Dead.
Oh,
if you've seen that. So,
I have not.
Oh, you haven't? Oh.
No.
Oh, if you watch the first season of The Walking Dead and then you watch The Mist, it's very similar. It's like the same vibe.
I've heard that The Walking Dead is very similar to... Game of Thrones, and no, not Game of Thrones, it's a different show. Anyway, I've heard that it's very like you have to really dedicate to it and make yourself sit through it because it's actually pretty boring.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, getting off tangent here, but in because I watched The Walking Dead for maybe 6 or 7 seasons and then I really dropped off, but they went through showrunners and directors like nobody's business, so it's kind of jarring for people who don't stick through it. Every season is just like so wildly different in the way that it's produced and the way that it's directed. But again, another story for another day. We should cover The Walking Dead at some point because it is fucking phenomenal. It's just a lot.
We could. And honestly, like, even if I don't watch it, because I know there it is, there's a lot of content there to consume. Even if I don't watch it, I'm glad to like do some research on it.
Yeah, and chat
see
about
what
it.
I can see.
Absolutely. Yeah, because I like I've seen most of it at this point. They just recently put up the last 2 seasons on Netflix, and so I've started slowly getting through those. And then there's a bunch of spinoff shows. There's the entire comic book series that it was based on. So like you said, like there's a whole lot to digest there.
Every time I think of like shows that were made based off comic book series, especially ones that aren't like anime and manga, like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
When I think of those, I think of the Umbrella Academy, because also Gerard Way, My Chemical Romance, one of my favorite bands.
Yes.
And so I'm like, oh, that's so nuts.
Because he
like,
was the writer of that one, right? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. Graphic novels are fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Like, they're typically pretty like quick to read a lot of times, but they're phenomenal. They can have really, really good, rich storytelling in them.
Yeah.
There's
absolutely
a lot of them we could cover.
There are. You
know, if we're just talking about like Walking Dead, Walking Dead's writer also did Invincible.
Ooh,
which is
okay.
Less horror, more like superhero, but it's definitely like mature content superhero stuff.
We could also do this one doesn't have a show made after it. It should, but Uzumaki from
Junji Ito.
Yeah.
Anything Junji Ito, we should definitely cover. But they they're coming out with a movie for that.
They are
Uzumaki. So have you seen Junji Ito's Macabre Tales? There's a series that's on Netflix that's all Junji Ito, and it's like it's a bunch of short stories that's based off of most of his works. But yeah, there's also a black and white film that's coming out at some point in the next just couple of years.
Ooh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll definitely have to cover that.
Oh, we should go see it in theaters. If it
absolutely
releases in theaters, I want to go see it.
It's like there's actually a few that are coming out to theaters that we're gonna need to go see. Like I think it's called Long Legs.
I haven't heard too much about that one, but
yeah. That one's supposed to be pretty good. There's The Quiet Place something, episode 1.
A Quiet Place, like the prequel.
Yeah.
That one's supposed to be really good. I guess it would be releasing in theaters. That would make a lot of sense. But yeah, there's a lot of good ones. There should be a new Saw movie this year or next year.
Oh, there's got to be.
I'm pretty sure like
it's
that's already in production. So, well, the 10th one had such a resurgence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
I heard
really
the 10th one was actually
really
good.
It's really good.
Yeah. I like Saw. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not by any means somebody that like is anti-Saw or anything like that. But I dropped off after like 4.
Yeah.
And I've heard that 10 for like the people that really loved the original ones kind of brought them back.
Well, yeah, because, you know, everybody just kind of missed it being about John Kramer's character.
Yeah.
And it very much kind of, he dies in the third movie, and then the rest of the movies are just kind of like they pepper him in there, John Kramer's character, but it's about his apprentices and it just gets really convoluted. There's like a healthcare one. That one's the best one. yeah, it's a good series. We should definitely, but healthcare anyways, one. We should circle back.
Oh yeah,
back.
We should circle
we
on
should
back.
Circle back.
Yeah.
I was going to bring up that The Mist is also, or Frank Darabont also directed like Shawshank Redemption. So
ooh,
he very much
okay.
has like a style when it comes to like directing.
Yeah.
There's like using dark shadows and really like dark sets. I feel like some of the music that he uses is very similar in terms of like the way that the soundtracks are laid out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm going to see if there's any other metadata I can throw in here. According to IMDb, it looks like Stephen King helped write this film. Maybe it was a similar Shining situation where like he wrote a screenplay for Frank and then Frank like went off of that. Stars Thomas Jane. Thomas Jane's been quite a few things. I'll kind of pull up IMDb, just kind of give you an idea. He's been in like 97's Boogie Nights. He's been in 1999's Deep Blue Sea.
That's where I knew him from. Deep Blue Sea. Oh my gosh, that's such a classic.
We've got Marcia Gay Harden plays Mrs.
Yes.
Carmody.
Yes.
And I was looking actually because I thought I had seen Marcia Gay Harden in like some other things, but I really remember her from The Mist. It looks like just if you look on IMDb, she's known for 2003's Mystic River, Into the Wild in 2007. So not a lot of movies that I personally remember seeing. And then the final actor that I have, this because it just gives you the top three, is Laurie Holden, who played Amanda.
Oh,
and
yeah,
she
yeah.
was in The Walking Dead. We were talking earlier about how, like, I think it was Nick that brought it up, that there were a lot of characters that were recycled from The Mist to the first season of The Walking Dead. And it's because it's true. There's, like, I think there's three actors in this that are in the first season.
Okay. Yeah, there's a bridge. We're going to have to cover Walking Dead.
We're going to have to cover it.
We're
going to
have to do it. I actually wrote in my notes, Marcia Gay Harden does so fantastically in this film because she plays the character that you are supposed to hate, the character that everybody does hate, but she does it so well. Like,
it's hard to find somebody who plays like a villain well. Like, that it isn't just like... That isn't just evil for the sake of being evil. I think Mrs. Carmody really represents like a very common outcome when like tension reaches an all-time high and there's some sort of stressful situation. Is like somebody needs people need answers
yeah.
when there's like uncertain times. And Mrs. Carmody very much symbolizes that person that like is confident enough that you believe her. And that
yeah.
like that is what's dangerous or can be dangerous.
Absolutely. And I think it's especially difficult for somebody to play a role that like, cause the primary antagonist isn't her.
Yeah.
She's just kind of like, maybe not even a secondary, maybe a tertiary antagonist.
I think she's like a catalyst.
And, yeah.
Like I think what she represents is more dangerous than what she does. If that makes sense. I mean, like,
yeah.
you know, because she's kind of like a spokesperson. She doesn't ever really, she gets other people to do things for her.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. She's very much so like the, for lack of a better example, she's like the Charlie Manson of the situation.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
No, that's a great example. I always like looking at some of the box office and like technical aspects because I always find those things kind of fun.
Yeah.
So, you know, this was released November 21st of 2007. So it was right around Thanksgiving time, which is kind of interesting. Filming locations. It was actually all filmed in Louisiana. They're like this because it all takes place in the
interesting.
Supermarket.
Interesting. Yeah.
It looks like box office budget was $18 million. This is all estimated. Opening weekend U.S. and Canada made $8 million. That was November 25th of 2007. And gross, it's made about $25 million in U.S. and Canada. And gross worldwide is about $57.5 million.
Truly, for the cost, that's not great.
That is, no. Especially, like, opening weekend.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't even make, what, a third? They made just over a third of their budget back if you're looking at $18 million. And then gross worldwide, we're looking at, like, I don't know how often they update these numbers, but it was in 2007. That was almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So $57 million over 27 years is not that. I mean, I don't know, though. I guess we'll find out just based off of seeing the metadata from other movies.
That's, yeah, I feel like, well, we've also, to be fair, like the movies that we've covered up until now, which may or may not be released at the point that anybody listens to this, they've all been like pretty monumental movies for the genre.
Sure.
Like, and not that The Mist isn't. It's, I mean, it's a King novel, novella made into a movie.
Right.
But it's, I feel like it's one of those ones that if you're a King fan, you've watched it. If you're not a King fan,
you probably,
or you're actively against King,
yeah,
then you're probably ignoring it.
Absolutely.
But still very good.
I'm sure it wasn't like a box office film, like a big ticket item, right?
Yeah.
Like it was one of the other ones that was playing in the theater, but not like the Titanic, the one that everybody was going to go see that weekend.
Yeah.
It probably wouldn't have been the Titanic in 2007, but you get what I mean. You get the gist.
And I have like a very light sprinkling of metadata as far as the book, because I'm very close to the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I already know what happens. The lightest little bit that I have of metadata for the book is that it was published in 1980, which for Stephen King, this was right toward when his alcoholism era turned into his cocaine addiction era. So it's not yet cocaine Stephen King, still alcoholism King. It's a very, very good short story that was initially published on its own, and then it was published in a series.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I can't remember the name of the series. It was Skeleton Something. Or at least I'm pretty sure it was Skeleton Something. And it was included in there as well. But it was one of the like short stories that somebody saw or they read and they were like, yeah, no, we're going to take this and run with it. We're going to make a movie about it.
Yeah.
And it truly great movie.
It had a fantastic premise. Like we were talking earlier when we were walking to go get food, that in my opinion, I love this movie. I try and watch this movie at least once a year because I just really enjoy it. And one of the things that I really like about it is just kind of the layers of terror that it ensues, right?
Yeah.
Pardon me. Like, I feel like the creatures and the monsters in this movie, they're like the least scary thing. Like, sure, they are terrifying. They're, you know, absolutely monstrous and all of these things, but it's like one of the last things in my mind. Like to me, it just seems like that's just nature, baby. Like we've opened a portal to another world and creatures came out and they're just doing like regular, like animal shit. Right.
Yeah.
And I feel like the more terrifying parts of this movie, I've always felt like my worst case scenario, the thing that would keep me up at night, I don't have any children, but being stuck in any type of apocalyptic type situation with a young child scares the absolute shit out of me. So that to me is like one of the biggest paramount points of this film. And then the secondary point is like, people are scary. And if you get them into a situation where, like my favorite quote in this movie, I'll come back to because I'm excited to talk about it, but is just about how people fundamentally are not good. And if we are not necessarily good, and if put into a stressful situation where they have no other option, they turn very animalistic very quickly, just like the creatures that are outside.
Yeah. And I actually have a bit to go into on that as well when we get to like our favorite scenes.
Yeah.
Section.
That's kind of what I was thinking too.
But yeah, there is something about this movie where it's a creature feature in the way that like there are these things that appear out of the mist, and one of the like more horrifying aspects of that is that you can't appeal to any sort of humanity in a creature.
Right.
Like it is going to be animalistic. It is going to do what that creature is just like evolutionarily made to do.
Absolutely.
And there's nothing you can do about that. Mm-hmm. But then the other side of it is that you do get to see just like raw human instinct when like terror is playing a part, and it is really interesting to see it
and how quickly we all turn into just like raging like monkeys.
Yeah, because truly, we're all just a bunch of assholes with a different like skin put on us.
Absolutely.
Like, so
yeah. We choose to have politics and rules. Like, yeah. Let's be very honest right now.
Yeah, we are all just electrified meat suits who yes. have decided like, oh no, this
I
is the
work
right
a
way
nine,
to act.
I want to work a 9-to-5 job every day.
Exactly. Yeah, we're forced to play a role in capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's. I'm excited to get into that part because there is definitely something that like. I want to talk about.
We can divulge in further.
So I'm down to do the synopsis, at least for the book and the movie are fairly similar.
They're fairly similar. Yeah. I mean, I haven't read the novella, but I'm sure we could find some differences in there. I know, and a lot of people probably know this too, because this movie is well over 20 years old, that the ending to this movie is different than it is in the book, but that Stephen King actually enjoys the ending to the movie better.
He felt
like his ending to the book was just kind of a little like anticlimactic and didn't really have a finite resolution. And sure, it was kind of like okay, you don't know what's going to happen. But in the movie, it is so much more visceral. And just, it is a scene that will forever live in history.
Absolutely. It is a hard to digest scene in the best possible way.
Absolutely.
And it's actually, it's in my list.
It's phenomenal.
Of favorite scenes.
Absolutely.
And just like, because as far as like what we're discussing, this actually kind of fits into this section rather than in like the facts/trivia section.
Uh-huh.
His inspiration for this movie literally just came from a trip to the grocery store after a thunderstorm. Like,
I saw that in the trivia.
Yeah. Like he was just walking through the grocery store and he's like, well, what if this place was like absolutely besieged by bugs and animals?
Right. And I was stuck in this store that like literally its entire front like wall is made out of glass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like I've read On Writing by Stephen King and he goes into kind of his process and like the way that he develops these stories. And it's literally just he will be in an area.
Yeah.
And he'll have heard about something like forever ago. And he'll just be like, well, what if that happened here?
Right.
And then he'll write about it.
Yeah.
And his approach we'll go into as we cover more of his approach to writing is really unique. And it makes sense why he is as prolific as he is. Whether for the good or the bad, but, it's
definitely entertaining.
That's it's just really interesting to like, see that these wild outlandish ideas come from just the most mundane things.
Yeah.
I think that the synopsis, since it's going to be spoiler free, it does kind of fit for both. I wrote a little one out. And let me know if you would like to add more
to your book synopsis or your synopsis in general
to just the general one.
Okay. A spoiler free synopsis.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So mine is a strange mist falls upon the city of Bridgeton, Maine, following a violent thunderstorm. As the citizens scramble to repair the damages, the mist envelops the town, exposing them to the horrors that roam within. Dun, dun, dun. Dun.
I mean, honestly, I really like that. Yeah, I like the detail of that. You know, they were in this horrific storm that they were like, oh man, that kind of sucks. And the next day, they're kind of like doing all their regular stuff to kind of prepare for repairs and all these things. Like, I think one of my favorite lines is when they're the son and the dad are leaving Dayton and Billy or David and Billy, and he's talking about how he needs to go to the store to pick up like tarps and tape and stuff so he can repair the side of the house, and you're like, oh well.
Yeah, it's like that's not gonna go how he thinks it's
going. You're
to.
Not gonna be coming back with that, sorry bud.
And if you're listening to this, you should have watched this to begin with. So now we're going to get into a space that will be spoilers.
Yeah, I liked that summary. So that's a very spoiler-free summary. Now we're definitely getting into spoiler territory because we have to actually talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no way not to.
No.
So kind of thematically, the things that are covered in this movie, the things that I want to make sure that we acknowledge is like one of the major themes throughout this film is man-made terror. Like this is as much as it is about, you know, the mist, the creatures that lie within, that sort of thing. Truly the horror that is contained within this movie is the people.
Yes.
And the like sci-fi element is what's happening outside. But the people really make this what it is. Another theme that is touched on, actually not just touched on, is really driven in this movie is religious fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm.
Like there, faith plays a huge role in this.
I'd also say brainwashing too, like yeah. just a little bit, like the idea of being able to call out coincidences and preach them as gospel and be able to like turn people's minds around and be like, no, no, no. Remember me? And when I like predicted that thing was going to happen, like you should keep listening to me because I must be onto something.
Yeah, absolutely. The Joseph Smith of it all.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I think, I think David was like, we got our own Jim Jones. We've got our yeah. own Jim Jones in the store right now. And I don't want to be here when people start drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because it is literally like this is a person who takes elements of what's happening, puts it in a religious font, and then is like, oh, yeah, don't you believe me? Because
mm-hmm.
obviously I'm the only one here who can be believed.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And she just kind of sits and waits, too. Like there's several opportunities where, you know, she stirs the pot or whatever, and she gets scolded for it, and she just kind of, she waits. She's patient. She's like, okay, well, my point will be proven eventually. And all she has to do is just keep saying the same thing over and over again in an uncertain time. And when anything even remotely lines up to it, you can be like, see, I predict that. You saw that. I predicted that.
Yeah. Which like fucking classic religion.
100%. Classic religion. 100%. Oh yeah. Take advantage yeah. of vulnerable populations, you know, when they're at their absolute lowest, yep. right? And just give them any sort of beacon, sliver, tether, anything, lifeline.
Yep. Yep. Let those people who are just at an absolutely ravishing sea have a lighthouse and they'll take it.
Have a buoy in the middle of the storm.
Yep.
That's willing to catch them.
I love that that's also the metaphor that we use when we're talking about Maine, because yeah. everything in Stephen King's novels is Maine,
and it's, everything, which is always funny yeah. because whenever I watch this movie as a kid, they mention Portland at some point, and I was like, what happens in Oregon? Yeah. Not that, you know, like Portland exists in a lot of places.
The right Portland.
The Portland.
No,
the
I'm right just Portland. Kidding. I actually really want to go to Portland, Maine. Like oh, every time I read anytime I read King, I want to go to Maine.
Right. Yeah. You're like, you know what? This sounds pretty dope. We should yeah, check it out.
There are these absolutely horrific things that are happening in the state. I must go.
We have to go.
Yeah.
We still have to go to Salem too.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Mom wants to go in, I think like September. So okay. we'll schedule okay. it.
We yeah. just need to schedule it out. September's a good time to go.
I feel like it is too. Apparently, Boston, Salem, like that whole area, they do have like four really good seasons. Yeah. So like fall time is the time to go.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, the last one that I wanted to touch on was like, this is Stephen King doing something that is horror, but also sci-fi, which is something.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it's a Stephen King Lovecraftian
yeah.
situation.
And I know I had mentioned earlier that I feel like Stephen King's It is also very like Lovecraftian and like sci-fi. But I don't yeah. actually know if it was 1980, if The Mist came out before it. I'm going to look it up real quick because I have the power of the internet in my fingers.
Yeah, sometimes I forget that the internet machine is like at our fingertips.
Stephen. You know, they're not together anymore and it's like really fucking sad.
That is really sad.
Mm-hmm. It's not. It came out and was released in 1986.
Ooh.
So it's after The Mist. So maybe it was like a preamble.
Yeah.
Because it is very sci-fi.
Oh, yeah.
There's a fucking extraterrestrial turtle drifting through space that belched up our universe in that book.
I need to read that book.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
I
that's
need
why
to read it
whenever
really
somebody, so people will come up to me and they're like, oh, I hate Stephen King's It. It's about a killer clown that eats children. That's not even like 30% of the novel. That's not even like.
I've heard Pennywise is like the smallest part of that.
The smallest part. Yeah, because he used Pennywise for just like 60 years, like out of the millions of eons that he's lived. Like Pennywise is like a, oh, 1930s, kids like clowns. I like kids. They're the tastiest meat. I'll be a clown for 60 years.
Children.
They taste so good.
Which also like, what a Stephen King thing to do. Like, it's always children.
Make children delicious. Is that what you're trying to insinuate?
Yeah. Like, and not at all to say that, like, Stephen King is any sort of.
No.
That, like, that sort of thing.
No.
He is one of the few people who doesn't have a problem with, like, killing a kid.
Yes.
He'll do it.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's a good point, right? Yeah. Right? Kids are not safe ground, right? And a lot of times they're the fodder, if we're being honest. And it's probably just because you get kind of like a visceral reaction from it. Because typically, like, kids are supposed to be untouchable. They're supposed to be safe because they're innocent and, you know, should be protected at all costs. But I think that sometimes does make things a lot more terrifying. It's one of the reasons why I won't watch Dr. Sleep, right? Yeah. It's got child torture in it.
And that is, like, children are supposed to be the safe space and things. And Stephen King's like, what if we torture it?
Well, yeah, it's like that's what will be more terrifying. Like, not even just like to see it from like a sadist point of view, because that's where my brain automatically went when you said that, was like, oh, does Stephen King hate children? Like, no, I think it's just, he understands that, like, they're fair game just like everybody else, and that they can provide like a much more visceral experience, because, you know, lots of people have kids and like they can't imagine something bad happening to their children.
That's also like, he does the same thing or a similar thing when it comes to like Cujo. He takes man's best friend, a Saint Bernard, also, that is like the least intimidating dog, and is like, hey, what if this thing was bloodthirsty?
What if it had rabies and like wanted to eat everybody?
I that's one of the things that I really appreciate about him. But I also think that this is a good, like, while we're generally talking about the movie and like King as a whole, I think this is a good time to bring up that a lot of the criticism that Stephen King gets is based off of the way that he writes about race and the way that he writes about women. Yeah. And I will say, reading the book doesn't touch on race elements and misogyny quite as much as the movie does. Like, it's lightly there, but I almost, this isn't to say that this is the case across the board, because a lot of his work does really go into some nasty things, the way that like the views are toward any person of color and women. But I almost kind of feel like the people who pick up the stories and decide to make a movie about it make it worse than the way that he writes it. And that's reflected on him more than it's reflected on them.
Yeah, it's like a trope that people are using, right? Where they're like, oh, well, Stephen King's known for this, so we really got to hammer it home when we're making our movie.
Yeah, because there's like a very, very blatant racist term in the movie. And there's a little bit of misogyny in the movie too that isn't in the book at all. And I'm always like, so is he getting a bad rap for things that directors are doing?
Right. It could be. He very well could be. Yeah. I'm kind of curious. I kind of want to know what this misogynistic scene was in the movie. Are you talking about...
It's... I think it's the way... I'm trying to remember it. I think it's the way that he is like speaking to Steph in the beginning. There's where he's just very kind of like patronizing to her that isn't there in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about it now.
And like the beginning of the movie, the section that has her in it is very short. Very, very, very short.
Yeah.
In the book, that's drawn out, and you get to actually see a little bit more insight into the relationship that those two have. And it is very much so like they get one another. It's not it's not a matter of like a, oh, this is just the woman who's at home, like that sort of thing. It's like, oh, this is something that's going to make her happy, so I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
And it's just a little bit more warm than
in the movie.
They're put out to be in the movie.
No, I agree with you. I do think in the movie, and I don't know if there's like an extended edition or deleted scenes or anything like that, but Steph, David's wife, does play a very insignificant role, right? Where you just kind of, you almost forget about her unless Billy's bringing her up, or towards the end when they go to try and rescue her from the house, right? Like, she doesn't play a key role in it.
No, and for like a 166 page book that's turned into a 2-hour movie, you would think she might have a little bit bigger of a part, but she's not super important. So
once Billy and David and Brett, what's the guy's name? The neighbor.
Brent. Is it Brent?
I think it's Brent.
Yeah, I think
when
it's
they
Brent.
Go to the grocery store, like there's no other way for Steph to come in unless Steven did his own, like did a sub chapter where it was from Steph's point of view, which would have been a really interesting.
That would have been interesting.
I mean, it would have been fucking tragic.
Yeah.
But it would have, I mean, I would have loved, I just in hindsight, just thinking about it now, I kind of would have loved it to see a chapter of her like trying her best, fighting them off, you know, maybe like killing a good portion of them, but still getting got in the end. Right. Or like, even if they like, they went through a portion of her chapter and then it just cut off. Like you didn't know what happened until they went to the house and yeah. found her.
Ooh, I'd like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be cool. Yeah, I wish I had written down the like specific piece of it. Actually, no, I did write it down. Mm-hmm. I wrote it down on a pastry bag at work that I put in my back pocket, and then it's still in my jeans from yesterday. but yeah, it's just like sometimes I just, it, not to say at all that he doesn't deserve it, because there are books where there is just a very stark, like, this is a racist element, this is a misogynistic element, sure. like those sort of things. But sometimes I do feel like he's getting just some sort of like rebound critique that really should have been given to the people who made the movie versus him.
Absolutely.
But that's still no excuse for him.
It's easy to place blame, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And truly it should be shared blame. But what is your favorite scene from the movie?
Well, I have a couple of them. I think my favorite scene from the movie, honestly, the one that like really encapsulates a lot of terror for me, and is like, even though the CGI is pretty bad, like it's still pretty entertaining. And I just love like the chaos of it. And it's the scene where, I think they're trying to turn on a generator, and it's just like David and Ollie and that teenager Norm and the two like maintenance guys,
Myron and Jim.
Yeah. And they all go into the back because they're like, they're trying to figure out how to turn the generator on, and they find out that the generator's just outside the door. I'm just going to describe this scene in great detail because it's great. And Norm like has the idea that they're going to open the door. He's going to jump out, turn the generator on, and come back in. And there's initially some argument because David doesn't want Norm. He doesn't want to do it in general, because yeah. if they open the door and there's something out there, whether it's a poisonous fog or monsters or whatever, like if it gets in the store, we're all fucked. Right.
Yeah.
But all the guys are like, no, we can do this. It'll be super easy. We'll get in and out really fast. And so then David just tries to tell Norm not to do it because he's a child. He's only like 18, 19 at this time.
Yeah.
And Myron and Jim do the worst thing ever. I think in the aftermath, I think it's Myron, the guy with like, well, I think they're both wearing hats. But anyways, he says something like, I didn't twist his arm. You know, I didn't tell him to do it. And it's like, no, you did the opposite.
His coping
like,
mechanism.
Yeah, you emboldened him. You were like, oh, you're a big badass. Like, you can do this, you know. And they open the door and some mist comes in. And like it's like a big tentacle creature. And it has like a bunch of claws and stuff on it. Grabs Norm, rips chunks off him. And it's so great because at this moment, when it grabs Norm and it starts eating him, Myron and Jim tune out. They just go, oh, fuck. And they back up to the back of the room. They don't help at all. So then it's just David and Ollie trying to save Norm and also stay away from this thing.
Yeah. And this Lovecraftian little.
And this monster. Yeah. This monster.
Has, like, teeth.
Oh, yeah. God. It was fucking. It's terrifying when he starts ripping chunks off of Norm. And, you know, eventually they cut the arm off. But both Myron and Jim aren't doing shit. They eventually get the door shut. And there's just this great moment where you see David. He's on the ground. He's covered in Norm's blood. And he just turns around. And I think he looks at Myron. And he just goes after him. He's like, yeah. You fucking son of a bitch. And it's a great scene. It's a fantastic scene.
And it's super like well deserved too.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause like at no part, at least during the book, and I'm a little bit more centered on the book right now because I've been reading it throughout the day today.
Sure.
In the book, for the most part, David is very even keeled.
Yes.
Like he doesn't have a whole lot of just like
outbursts.
He's not a super like a macho sort of guy or anything like that. And so the times that he does get to that heightened level, it is very much so deserved.
Absolutely.
And in that situation, especially, he's like, yeah, no, his blood is on your hands.
Yeah. Yeah. And you didn't even bother to like help us when we needed it. Right. Like just what good are you even?
Yeah. Okay.
And more so like I'll just bring this up to because it kind of plays into the themes of this movie. And it's also kind of plays into my favorites. But there's a quote in this movie. It's my favorite quote that I've ever heard. And it's when David is trying to find, he's talking to Amanda and a couple of other people in the store. He's talking about how they need to leave, right? And how things are just going to get worse. Not just because the things outside are going to get in or because they're going to run out of food, but Mrs. Carmody slowly gaining a congregation. Yeah. And he's like, at some point, people are just going to start being on the chopping block when she needs sacrifices, right? And like, who do you think's going to be the first on the chopping block but the people that are actively against what she's doing? And Amanda, you know, pipes up and she says, come on, we're a civilization. We're a good, like, we're decently good people. And David says,
not when there's a trauma response.
Yeah, and David says this great line where he was like, yeah, as long as the phones can work and you dial 911, but you take that stuff away, you throw people in the dark and you scare the shit out of them, no more rules.
No more.
I love that line so much. It's like, yeah, we are a civilized society until there's nothing, there's no more society left.
Very, very close to that line in the book when they talk about the blood sacrifice situation.
Yeah.
In the book, it's like Carmody says something and they're like, oh, before too long, she's going to be asking for a blood sacrifice. And then next paragraph, directly after that, blood sacrifices in italics. And it's like, now that's on his mind.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's like, it's just one of those things where you really do focus in on the, oh, she is brainwashing people. And this is absolutely what comes next.
Absolutely what comes next. Yeah. Because when she's got people believing that she knows the future, then when the monsters start coming for their nightly meal, she's just going to start throwing people to them to appease her gods. Yeah. You know?
And absolutely the first person that's going to go is the first person that is in opposition to her.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're going to be the non-believers that have to be sacrificed. Yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
But
what's your favorite scene?
Okay. So I wrote down a favorite for the book and the movie.
Oh, nice.
In the movie, I actually have two for the movie.
Oh, that's fine.
So the first one is, I cannot remember the name of the character. It's the older lady.
Oh, I got you.
She is,
I love her my so much.
Favorite character in
when
this.
She's fucking throwing peas at, oh, Mrs. Carmody.
Yes.
And she's just like, people stone people in the Bible when they don't agree with them.
Exactly.
So yeah. Great.
So that scene, when she calls Carmody a buzzard.
Her name's Irene.
Irene. When Irene calls Carmody a buzzard, that is my favorite thing.
It's so goddamn
great.
It is
so good.
It's iconic.
I will also say, kind of like backtracking a little bit to the scene that happens in the loading dock. As soon as that door is opened, when me, Mom, and Nick were watching it last night, we were all like, oh, that's on him.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, don't try to save him. He's gone.
No.
Bye.
Bye.
And just like that unanimous response to that, literally like all three of us at the same time were like, that's on him. But then my second favorite like scene in the movie, besides Carmody being called a buzzard, is the end.
Is the ending.
Yeah. I feel like we might want to save that a little bit.
We can save it a little bit. I mean, yeah. We could talk about some of our other... Like, I think one of the best parts about this movie is that you don't see the creatures that much.
Yeah.
You get very small glimpses of them. I can probably agree that a lot of that had to do with the time period and it was just hard to CGI those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But truly, I always feel like the less you see, the better.
Yeah.
And it gives you such a crazy like reaction in just those small moments when you do see just how big those creatures are.
Yeah.
Like when they're running to the car towards the end, and you see those big creatures that are just like walking over the parking lots.
There is actually, and we covered this, we touched on this a little bit in another movie. But there was an element of this that I wanted to call back, which was scary things are happening during the day. And like,
yeah,
when the tentacles come out in the loading dock, it's daytime. At the very end, when they're seeing everything kind of like walking through, it's daytime. And like this fog/mist in the book, they reference it as a fog a lot more.
Oh, that's so interesting. Because it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, same thing. But they talk about how there is no like light refraction. There is nothing in this. It is just pure white.
You can't see anything.
You can't see anything. Mm-hmm. Like it is almost like a blanket is being thrown on whatever is in front of you.
100%. It's like that in the TV show too, which we should cover at some point. Because there are several times in the TV show, in the movie, they're really stuck in the supermarket.
Yeah.
They go to like the pharmacy at one point and then go to the parking lot, but that's it. In the movie, or in the TV show, there's a lot more traveling that has to be done in the mist. And there's a lot more kind of supernatural things where sometimes the mist will play with you and make you see things that aren't really there.
Ooh, okay.
But that's just an aside.
Oh, yeah. We should definitely cover that because this is a concept that's also apparently... This mist is brought back in the Dark Tower series.
Oh, is it? Oh, that's cool. I really like that.
Yeah.
I've heard great things,
but I haven't consumed any of that.
I'm pretty sure that the Arrowhead project is also well known like throughout some of Stephen King's works too.
Oh,
like,
okay.
I'm pretty sure. I'm not 100% sure, but yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely. I mean, no matter what, we're going to end up doing a lot of King things.
Oh, we're doing this weekly now, so we're probably going to be doing quite a bit.
Yeah. Book wise, my favorite scene you actually already mentioned, and it's kind of more of a section, and it's the section when they first enter the back room up to the part where he is trying to like drag Norton into the loading dock to show him the severed tentacle.
Are you talking about David is dragging who?
David is dragging
the manager.
He's dragging, no, because manager's last name is Brown, I believe.
Uh-huh.
It's his neighbor, the lawyer.
Oh, Brent.
Brent.
Oh, yeah. Yes. He's trying to convince him to go into the back room.
Yeah, he's trying to convince him
thing.
To go into the back room.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit of a big section. It even actually goes a little bit further than that. But the thing that I kind of want to call out in this section is that the characters at this point, there's not a ton of substance to each individual character.
Sure.
But he builds these characters entirely off of their response to this trauma. So it's like the way that I wrote it was there was turning the situation into a macho charade sort of situation, which is what Myron and Jim did.
Mm-hmm.
There's putting a mental block on the situation by pretending that the threat isn't real, like Brent Norton did.
Right.
There's turning to faith, like Miss Carmody did. There's protecting the store, like Brown did. And then there's Mr. McVeigh cooking for the people just to try to like do what he normally does and keep his mind off of it, even though nobody's eating anything. And then there's Mrs. Terman who's watching Billy, and she's just like babysitting as a way to like keep her mind out of the fact that her partner is also out in the mist.
Right.
And so there's like all of these different people who at this point are barely characters in this. And really, he is just developing these people off of this trauma response. And it is such a cool thing because you can almost kind of jump into his shoes at that point once you know about the way that his writing method goes, where you can be like, oh, he didn't even think of these characters until he's like, well, what if somebody reacted like this?
Did something, to them, and they had to react this way. I do like that a lot, too, because during a trauma response, a lot of people would... they would fall into whatever their fight or flight response would be, which would not be indicative of their true character.
No, not at all.
It would be a very different version of yourself that is just built for survival mode.
Yeah, because there's a concept in psychology that states that like your initial reaction is your conditioned reaction and your secondary reaction is who you actually are.
Interesting.
And when you're in a fight or flight situation, it's all conditioned reaction.
Right.
So it is exactly how you are taught to behave in those scenarios, and that is it. And so every character in this book is essentially just conditioned.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's exactly the way that they are just taught
acting
to behave.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily the way that they are as people.
Yeah. That is so interesting. I really like that you brought that up.
That was my favorite for both the book and the movie. What's the scariest scene to you? Mine's so generic. Like it is white boy generic. Yeah.
I feel like I already touched on my layers of fear earlier, where like one of my worst nightmare scenarios is being in a life or death situation where I have a young child like in my care, because it's one thing to be able to parse out something not only traumatic but also dangerous when you're an adult and you're like, I can do this, I can handle this, but to then have to safeguard a child and protect their humanity at the same time, couldn't do it. So I don't really want to bring that up because it just seems kind of like a cop out. So I'll say another thing that really is existentially scary that I found very scary about this movie is definitely the spider guy in the pharmacy.
It's so funny that you say that.
Is it? Well, absolutely, that would be your scariest scene.
Yeah.
Because you're arachnophobic to a T.
Yeah. Yeah. I've started to get over it.
Well, I feel like you should describe this scene then.
You know?
Do you want me to?
Describing the scene is hard because I'm
watching
first,
him squirm in his chair right now.
Yeah. Okay. So the thing is, I've worked on my arachnophobia. Okay. I'm trying my hardest. I don't kill them. I try to put them outside. Like, I'm doing what
they're
I can.
Good creatures.
Although also putting them outside apparently is the wrong thing to do because they'll die outside too. So
they're going
to
die anyway.
I don't know where to put, do I put them in like my bed? I don't know what the right spot is. So
you put them in another spot of your house that you don't care about or go in ever.
I'll just put them in a plant.
Yeah.
They can live in a plant.
That's what I would do.
Yeah.
Live in a plant.
Yeah. I'll just, Leela can play with it. Anyway. So the thing is, I am the first person to say that the CGI for this movie is terrible.
Sure.
So I don't get scared by the majority of the creatures that are happening in this movie.
Yeah.
But anything spider related is going to get me.
I gotta tell you, those spiders are pretty freaky looking.
They're like, pretty gross.
Like, even the big ones, like the fucking big ass ones that jump on top of the shopping carts and stuff. I could not handle those spiders.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's like kill with a flamethrower type spider.
Yeah. And like, as such, I listen to this scene more than I watch it.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah. I'm getting the runaround
and, like,
now.
I will watch people literally get torn limb from limb. Yeah. Like gore
by any other creature.
That's not a thing.
Sure.
For me. But like even playing Zelda when the spiders come up and it's, I can't do
like,
it.
No,
they're big. They're scary.
They're scary.
I don't want to shoot them with my little toothpick. I don't, that's not my thing. Like I don't want spiders involved.
Oh, I was literally just laughing. Cause I realized that I brought up flamethrowers and that's literally what Irene did.
It is.
Uh-huh. With the hairspray and the lighter.
It
worked good.
It is. And do you remember, I brought up toothpicks. And do you remember when you used to use rubber bands and toothpicks and
to
shoot
kill
them at spiders?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I did. I do remember doing that. It was barbaric.
Yeah, you hindsight. Were good at it too.
I was really good at it. I had a lot of practice at your house.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I was like running away and saying, Karina, kill it.
Yeah, I get it. I think there was once you woke me up in the middle of the night to kill a spider. And so I killed it and I put it on your bed. You slept on the floor with me.
I was probably like 7 or 8, and I woke up, my dad was living with my aunt at this point, and so he didn't even have a bedroom. She had 2 kids, 3-bedroom house, so her and her kids had rooms.
Okay.
Dad was sleeping somewhere. Honestly, I don't even know.
Somewhere.
And I was sleeping on an air mattress in their living room when I would go see him.
Right.
And I woke up on the air mattress one morning and looked over, like I rolled over, and on my pillow there was a daddy long leg. And it freaked the shit out of me. And I'm sure that's where my arachnophobia came from.
Absolutely.
But like that, every single time I see a spider, it's like that reaction.
It's like
what happens.
A visceral reaction. Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I'm trying to imagine what that reaction would be for me, but I'm blanking on it right now. It's a matted doodle.
And on
every time I see a fucking doodle that really needs a haircut, I'm just like, please God, no.
You know what? Don't get those dogs if you're not going to cut their hair.
Don't come here.
Just it is that is a terrible hair texture to not take care of.
Oh God, I know. It's literally the worst dog breed. But I love the phrase, if you know brushy brushy, I shavy shavy.
Exactly. God, they really are a genetic nightmare.
It's bad. So let's see. You did your scariest. Do you want me to describe the scene since you didn't really watch it?
You can go ahead and describe it because I don't need to relive that trauma.
Is it the entirety of the pharmacy scene or is it just with the dude? It's probably most of it.
It's really just when the spider first like shows up.
Yeah.
Or when the spiders first show up.
Yeah.
So it is kind of, halfway through the pharmacy scene.
Yeah.
Because get in and rummage around a little bit.
They get in,
the
they rummage around. They actually get all of their medication.
Which honestly, I'd be taking everything.
I know, like, right? Why are you looking for just like random? I mean, you might want to look to make sure you're getting the stuff you want, but then like just fucking take whatever you can fit. Take at least one of everything.
Absolutely.
Antihistamines, especially painkillers.
Uppers, downers, candy corns, anything
take
you can get.
All that shit. Yeah. You're gonna need it. Like,
this
trust
is,
me.
This is before they tried to reduce plastic bags. There's gotta be a rack of them somewhere. Throw all that shit
throw
in it and go.
Throw all that shit in a bag. I think the only reason why they kind of picked up their pace is when they found the dude, they found the guy, and they he was alive. He like woke up and said, "Help me!" And so they're like, "Okay, let's try and get him like untied."
And this motherfucker didn't wake up until he was like grabbing at somebody.
Yeah,
essentially.
Yeah. Somebody walked by.
Yeah, he couldn't
have
like
Jim.
Yeah, yeah. He couldn't have moaned or something before that. No, he had to wait until he had to jump scare somebody.
Well, that was in the plot. I don't think that was on him.
Also, don't mind me, a horror fan, being like, "Why do you have to jump scare?
Jump scare me like that." It's true. Lots of jump scares are kind of cheap like that. I wanted to actually find and see if I could find this specific scene in here. Oh, well, they only do it in like a really small scenario. But one of the craziest things that happens with these giant spiders is that their webs are acidic, like caustic.
Yeah.
When they touch you. That was probably one of the worst parts for me, too, is just like how much damage it did. I was honestly surprised in hindsight that dude that was like tethered up and was filled with a bunch of baby spiders wasn't just a meat sack, like a meat suit. Like, how did not, maybe they have like a different type of thread that they use to wrap up their victims versus the ones that they use to like attack somebody with a ranged web shot.
Yeah.
But
yeah, maybe it's just your standard like butt noodle versus some sort of like acidic butt noodle.
I'm kind of curious. I mean, honestly, like, just from the zoology part of my brain, I'm just like, what the hell are these spiders like built for? Right. Yeah. Like, it just kind of seemed like the venom shooting webs was more cinematic than it was like. They were like, well, these spiders can't just be scary and like eat people. They also have to shoot acidic webs.
What if they just really like pickles? What if they're just
they love peppers, like Thai chilies, serranos,
truly ghost. It's just a way to put like a capsaicin and pickle scenario on everything that they're gonna eat.
Just like sprinkling it on all of their food.
Yeah,
but yeah, so they go into this pharmacy, they're looking for medical supplies. It's like a small group of them, like five or six dudes, but they end up losing a couple of them that go in with them. One of them is, I'm pretty sure, the grocery store manager.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he's Brown. One of the dudes that dies. Yeah, Brown.
I can't remember what his first name is. Bill, maybe?
It doesn't fucking matter,
no,
honestly.
No, he's a prick through the whole thing anyway.
Yeah,
so.
But when they go in, you know, they're looking for all the medical supplies, and as they're leaving, they initially see this guy. He's from Project Arrowhead because he still has his like army uniform on, and he's strung up against the wall, and they think he's dead. But when they walk past him to go out, and they're kind of like, they're pretty sure something's in the shop. And I think one of them says, like, we got to get out of here. I hear something. Like, I hear, like, skittering sounds. They walk past the Project Arrowhead dude, and he wakes up. He tries to grab them, and then he just cries, like, help me, help me. So they all, like, they try to get him down, and then he says, like, I can feel them inside me. I can feel them, like, moving. And then he kind of just, like, goes wide-eyed and, like, goes unresponsive. And he falls, like, while the rest of the spiders are attacking them and they're trying to get their way out, he falls onto the ground and his back just, like, explodes open and a bunch of just, like, baby spiders crawl out from every direction.
In that moment, he turns into that one Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark story with the girl that's got spiders coming out of her face.
But it's his whole body. Ugh. Like, it's his whole back. Yeah.
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 It is bad. Literal nightmare.
No shit. Like, being impregnated by any sort of creature, like, just to carry their eggs and have them burst out of you, like, any sort of, like, alien situation, oh, fuck no.
Yeah,
that's some body horror I don't need in my life.
Like, throw me into literally any jigsaw situation, and I'd take that over that.
100% of the time. 1,000% of the
time. Like, kick me into a pit of needles, and that's fine.
Do not. Fine. Don't impregnate me with a bunch of spiders that are just going to eat me alive and burst out of my back, please.
Yeah, don't make me a spider mom. I'm not built for parenthood.
I'm not built for parenthood. All right, so that was scariest scene.
Yeah.
So we got trivia.
Yeah.
But you know what? There's quite a bit of trivia in here, so I'm really going to just like touch on some of the you know, the like most popular points.
Do what feels good.
Just to save on time here.
Yeah.
I did find this interesting that Stephen King says that he was actually genuinely frightened by the adaptation, by this adaptation of his novella. He stated that the ending to this movie was better than the ending that he wrote to his book. And Frank Darabont described that as the happiest moment in his career.
Truly, that it should be.
Yeah, that he truly scared Stephen King with an adaptation, because this was actually Frank's third adaptation of a Stephen King book.
Ooh, okay.
The Green Mile, Shawshank
Redemption. Oh my God. The Green Mile. We'll cover that. It's not a horror movie, but we'll cover that at some point.
Yeah. It'll be an offshoot for a Stephen King.
Holy hell, that's going to be a lot.
Yeah. That's going to be like a two-parter for sure.
Yeah. Actually, though, I can kind of return to favorite movie scene now that we've touched on the end.
Sure. Yes.
And like why it's so much better.
Well, we should definitely do the ending scene, because it's fantastic.
So I haven't finished the book all the way through yet, but from what I hear, I'm like 20 pages out.
I was like, I could tell you the ending of the book. I know what the ending is.
I've heard that the ending is that there really isn't much of an ending. It's just like the mist is still there. And then like,
it's just about the group that escapes from the grocery store. They all make it to the car, Billy, David, Amanda, and then Irene, and the first guy that runs in. Somebody took John Lee in the mist, that guy.
Yeah.
They all get into the car and they drive off into the mist. And they're like, we got this much gas. Hopefully we'll make it where we're going. And that's kind of how it ends. It just ends with like them just driving off into the mist. They got into the car. They got out of the grocery store. But
ooh, then yeah, this director is twisted.
Yeah.
Because that's about what I heard too. Mm-hmm.
It's so much better. Tell it.
So then my favorite scene from the movie is... that happens, that exact thing happens. Yep. They get in the car, they have this much gas, and they're like, all right, we're just gonna drive. And then they drive, they run out of gas, and then they remember, oh, we have this gun.
Yep.
And in but this gun there are four bullets,
four bullets
there
for
are five people in the car. And so David shoots Irene, the old guy, who
I think his name's Dan,
maybe Dan,
I think it's
something
Dan,
something like that.
Yeah.
And Amanda and his son, Billy.
And I just want to preface this here. His name's Dan. Because this is really cool. The way that they do it in the movie. I don't know how they don't do it in the book. But the grownups don't want Billy to know what's going on.
No.
Because he's a child, right? And so they're all having this... they're all like stopped. They don't have any gas, and they kind of look around and they're like,
and
hey,
he wakes up a little bit.
And like, they just like, they look at all the bullets and they're like, we only have four. And they're like, okay, who's going to do it? And they all just, you know, David is kind of like, I'll do it. And so they all just kind of like, you know, they get prepared and whatever. And he tries to make it so that it, like David tries to make it so it's very fast. So he loads it up and he just like, you don't see him actually shoot anybody.
Nope,
it actually,
it's all outside
it's
of the
beautiful
car.
It's a beautiful shot.
Very well done shot.
Yeah. And you just hear the four bullets and then you just hear David crying.
You hear the four bullets. So the shot is, it's essentially an external view of the car, and it's enshrouded in the mist, and you just see a flash in the car for each shot.
Yeah.
And then it goes back into the car.
Yeah.
And it's just David, and you can see
everybody,
Irene and what's his nuts in the back, Dan in the back of the car, and they're leaning against the windows. They've obviously been shot in the head.
Yeah.
And it never shows the kid. It never shows Amanda.
No. Yeah.
But then he gets out of the car, drops to his knees. He's crying. He's like,
come and get me.
Yeah.
He's like, all right, let's go.
Yeah. Like, he's at this point where he's like, it's going to kill me anyway. So just like, come get me.
Yeah.
And then the military comes through.
Yeah.
And they start destroying all of the creatures, and the mist starts to dissipate,
mm-hmm.
and he lives.
Yeah.
And he has to live with the fact that he just killed his son.
He killed all of these people that didn't need to die, and that he was seconds away from rescue, minutes away from rescue.
It was literally like within a minute.
Like, I don't know, man. Like, if I would have been in this same scenario, I would have waited a day. Like, I would have waited until things would have started, like, attacking the car before I don't know if that was to spare Billy necessarily that trauma, but, like, I would have waited until we were starving to death before I started popping people, like, in the backseat.
Yeah, like, boy, he's already gone through all this trauma.
And you're just
another day
him?
In the car.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah.
So I did think, and maybe it was, I mean, I do remember in the movie, you know, they're sitting there and the cars run out of gas. And I think they do, like, they're hearing stuff outside. And so it's kind of like a hopeless moment situation where you're like, well, we're delaying the inevitable right now, you know, like,
yeah,
might as well just cut and run. But I don't know. I think I definitely would have waited.
They are also at the end of day three of this. Like, if
crazy
some shit's going on, I'm going to give it a week. Like, I'm going to give it at least a long weekend.
Yeah.
Like, it's it.
And you're really, like, you are so safe in that car. Like, as long as you don't make a ton of noise. I mean, the true thing that would suck is that you wouldn't be able to go to the bathroom. You wouldn't have any water or food. Like, you would truly be, like, fucked.
Yeah.
Otherwise.
Which, like, at that point, everybody better be into water sports. I'm pissing on somebody. You got to do what you got to do in those scenarios, but I can sleep for a day in the car.
Yeah. And I don't know. This is all hindsight, right? Like, I'm not in this situation, obviously. And it seemed, you know, they like Frank came up with this, like we were saying earlier, came up with this ending and it was awesome.
Yeah.
Because of how, like, sad it was. Because it was just like, oh, fuck, man, that sucks. If you just waited just 5 more minutes, they would all be alive again and everything would be fine. And it's great. They do have this really nice ending scene where, like, the military runs up and he's devastated, you know, and he sees them.
And they're ignoring him.
Well, no, I think one of them comes up and they're like, hey, are you okay?
After a little bit, yeah.
But initially he's just, like, inconsolable on the ground, and you see, like, some of the vehicles passing by, and you see the mother that, like, left the grocery store at the very beginning, and she's like, will anybody see a lady home? Because she had to go pick up her kids, and, like, she's in there and her kids are there.
Yeah.
I'm almost wondering, like, I thought about this when I was watching this movie earlier. She must have lived really close by. It was either she must have lived really close by, or, like, she went when there weren't really anything out.
Oh, yeah. She must have lived, like, in an apartment on top of the pharmacy or, like, some shit like that.
Because
there's, like, no other way.
I don't get it.
In
I don't
book,
understand.
They talk about the pharmacy being, like, 20 feet from, like, the front door of the pharmacy is supposed to be, like, 20 feet from the front door of the grocery store. She must have lived, like, 30 feet.
Yeah.
From the grocery store. Because, like, otherwise that wasn't going to work.
I wonder. I truly wonder.
Yeah.
But anyways.
There's, like, quite a few military personnel who pass by him while he is just devastated
on the ground. Yeah.
And they're just, like, going past him. And then eventually somebody's like, yeah, you good? And it's like,
are you all right? And I can't quite remember, but I think some of them, like, start to look in the car too. And it's like, you can almost see, like, the brain cells coming together. Like, oh shit. Like, he just, oh no.
Yeah. And it truly though, that was one of the first movies I feel like that I saw an ending quite that just dreadful.
Yeah.
And
down. There was no happy ending. And, like, you know, horror movies don't necessarily have to have a happy ending, but, like,
and truly I appreciate when they don't.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But, like, typically the ending is not, like, that much of a punch in the dick.
Yeah, typically you don't have to shoot your kid and then live afterward.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But truly, like, shoot the kid before you shoot a dog.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll digest a kid dying far better than a dog.
I was going to say, at least it isn't in the tall grass. Stephen King.
Uh-huh. So
shall we do our rating?
I have a couple.
You got more?
I just have a couple more trivia things.
Okay. I'll see if I have any others in here.
So in the book, right after the storm, and this isn't, I guess, trivia so much as it is just, like, things that I appreciated about the book.
Yeah.
In the book, right after the storm, one of the things that is happening on the property is that some power lines had fallen because of the intense winds that were happening through the storm.
Right.
And when they go out to check everything after they come out of the basement and see that everything is safe as far as going outside, Billy like runs around, he's like looking at things, and they see these power lines that are laying on the ground, and they're kind of like twisting and sparking and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And he instills, or he like tells Billy, like, stay away from those. They're not trying to shock you. They're just looking for the ground, like that sort of thing.
Right.
But then quite a little bit later, when they're in the store, King, describes the anxiety that Billy is experiencing to these live wires, and like kind of calls back to these wires that are twisting on the ground and everything. And I just loved the way that he did that, yeah, where he like brought that back to it. Because they're really like, those are used to build the tension in the very beginning of,
absolutely,
like, oh, there, this is still, that's a dangerous situation.
Yeah, right.
And then to like call back to that in a way of like, oh, this is still a dangerous situation. And it's also Billy. At yeah. this point, is he's these live wires.
Yeah.
So I really appreciated the way that he wrote that. And there's just two quotes. The first one being something that kind of calls back to when we talked about Drain and how like the people are what make Drain not the greatest spot.
Yes.
The quote is, "They had that sort of light in their eyes that some men get when they go shooting rats at the town dump." And that's like something that I feel like we've seen in Drain, where it's like you can see when people just get that like electric look in their eyes of like, I'm doing this.
Fucking Christ.
Yeah. And it's like some dumb machismo shit that they're just like, I'm just going to do it.
I'm just going to do it.
Mm-hmm. And that was like one of those things that just kind of gave me,
you're like, oh,
a little bit.
Fuck. Yeah. That hit a little too close to home, I think.
And then this one is just kind of a general, like, this is a really good way to just, I guess, describe this subject as a whole. Mm-hmm. And it's, terror is the widening of perspective and perception, where no matter what, if you are stuck in a scenario like this, it is challenging every view that you have, every belief that you have.
Yeah.
And it is forcing you to widen those perspectives.
Yeah.
And for some people that results in, you know, XYZ, it results in faith. It results in trying to block it out. It results in trying to be extra macho about the situation.
Sure.
But everybody's going to have a response to that forced widening of perspective. And it's the way that he called that back to that just being terror.
That is so interesting.
Really beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. And just that there are so many things in this movie to be scared of that isn't necessarily like the creatures that are outside.
Yeah.
It's like a lot. It's like a lot of different things. Not only like being pitted against survival, against something that you have very little knowledge about, but it's also being pitted against the same survival against people that you know, you've known every day.
Yeah. These are just everyday people in this town.
Mm-hmm. And some of them are like, they make it seem like this town is not necessarily a tourist trap, but like gets a fair amount of tourists. Cause there's like a couple of announcements that are done where I think Ollie's telling everybody about Mrs. Carmody, just from the people who aren't from town. Like Mrs. Carmody's kind of known as like, you know, the town kook or the town pariah, yeah, or whatever.
There is that element of almost kind of the way that people perceive Oregonians' view of Californians, where, yeah, it's that very like, this is our space, not yours.
Right.
And like, you don't belong here.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, prevalent as far as small town attitudes, behaviors, or attitudes go.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's that very like, for the people that aren't from here, this is XYZ. And actually in the book, they touch on that just a little bit, because the person who offers up the gun is somebody who is from out of town. And in the book, he's like, prior to that scene, he talks about how like, oh, you know, I pay my taxes here. Like, I got absolutely stiffed on this house, like that sort of thing. And he's kind of joking with everybody about,
sure,
it. And that kind of gains a little bit of camaraderie between him and the rest of the townsfolk.
Mm-hmm.
And then he offers up the gun and they're like, hey, you know, you stepped up to the plate. You did what you could. And he was like, cool. Does that reduce my taxes at all? Like that sort of thing. And so they're like, that plays in a little bit more in the book in a really comical way. And that's that little bit
it's
of relief.
It's like a little bit of relief there.
Yeah.
Was that your last piece of trivia?
Yeah.
So I had said earlier that there were three people in this film that were in season one of The Walking Dead, but there were actually nine.
Wow.
I was actually just looking on here. I counted 9, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 people were in The Walking Dead.
So The Walking Dead really was just like, hey, you ever watch The Mist? You want to
like, I guess Darabont has like, has the mind to do that. I guess it's not unusual for him to do that, to either shoot on tight schedules, work with certain companies because he wants to save a buck, or like reusing actors because he already has like a good rapport with them, and almost like making characters for them in movies so that he can hire them.
I guess that's kind of like the Burton, Winona Ryder, Johnny Depp situation.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And even like, you know, Mike Flanagan, like there's several directors who do that now where they find somebody they really like and they just hire them almost exclusively.
Yeah. So that's like, that's their person. I mean, not even bringing in the tiny little bit of theater knowledge that I've gained from being with Nick, that's even like a Sondheim Bernadette Peters sort of situation where it's like everything he makes is going to try to have her in it.
Yeah.
So
yeah, even if he has to like build an entire persona or character around that person to then incorporate them, it's very clear from the get go.
So I guess rating, scariness wise, I didn't necessarily think personally that this movie is all that scary, and it could be because of the terrible CGI, but I did still give it a pretty middle of the road rating because any sort of religious zealot is going to gain a little bit of scare in my book.
Sure.
Growing up in Drain, religion's scary. It can be a very welcoming scenario in the worst of ways, and it can be a very isolating scenario in the worst of ways too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then on top of that, spiders. So I rated the scariness a 3 out of 5.
3 out of 5.
I thought I wrote it down. So it's going to be 3 out of 5 apple trees through a picture window.
Iconic.
Yeah. Quality because of the terrible CGI.
Does it have to have killed somebody? The weapon? I guess it doesn't. It's just whatever weapon you want to use.
If it does have to have killed somebody, I can change it. And I'm going to make it, 3 out of 5 loading bay doors. Because arguably it killed part of a tentacle. Yeah.
Yeah. And the axe did the other half.
Yeah. Quality, I'm going to give it a 2 out of 5 because CGI, and I was going to give it a 1, but it's bumped up because of the really great portrayal of Carmody.
For the quality.
That brings the quality up a bit for me. Rewatchability, I gave it a 2 out of 5. It is long.
Like, yeah, 2 hours is a long time for a movie.
Yeah, it is a long movie. It is good.
Yeah.
But it is long.
But there are some scenes that I think are drawn out a little bit.
Yeah.
That could make it shorter and then would be more digestible.
And then I did also, I was going to give it a 3 for that reason. But I bumped it down just a little bit because of the really stark racist term that's in it, which I know that's a thing for its time.
2007, I don't think gives him that much of a pass.
That's true. Actually, that is true.
That was only a year before we elected. I almost said hired. We elected Obama.
Well, our government is a business.
It's true.
So yeah, I think there is like the racist term that has also reflected on King versus the movie, and
right.
That term is not in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that part. So that gave it a 2 out of 5 for me. Rereadability, however, I gave it a 5 out of 5.
Oh yeah. I'm really excited to read it because I know I will love it. For my ratings, I am kind of torn. I think I want to do those pterodactyl monsters because they are fucking cool. And they killed some people in some gruesome fucking ways. So I'm going to do, for scariness, I'm trying to think of this from like a generic audience member, somebody who's not like a huge horror fan almost. And I'm thinking about giving it a bit more of like a 3.5. I'd say it's fairly scary, but it's not super existentially scary. It wasn't a movie that would ever like keep me up at night, would make me think like, oh no, this could actually happen. Like I never felt like that when watching it. Rewatchability, I think I might be a little bit biased because I love it so much. Like, I find this movie incredibly entertaining from start to finish. Yeah. So I would probably give it more like a 3.5 pterodactyl monsters out of 5. And then for quality, I think about less of the CGI and I think about more of the acting that's done in it.
Okay.
I do really like the acting. I sometimes feel like David is a little bit over the top. Like, I'm sure in the book he's probably a little bit more toned down, and he is very toned down in the movie, but then there are also times where he dials it up to an 11 and it almost seems like he's trying too hard.
Yeah.
So I would give the quality of this film, like, I'll give it like a 2.8. It's like almost a 3, but it's not quite a 3. Pterodactyl monsters out of 5.
I like that.
So it's like, it's a fairly low score overall, but it's still something that I come back to all the time.
So that puts me at an average of 3 out of 5 loading bay doors.
Mine would be just under a 3. It'd be a 2.93 pterodactyl monsters out of 5.
Great. I could have done acidic web. Whatever. We'll revisit
acidic
it.
Acidic web spiders. the scariest thing about those spiders was how humanoid their faces were.
Yeah.
Freaked me out about those spiders.
Yeah. Don't be doing that shit.
Don't be doing that shit.
No.
But anyways, I think that about wraps up The Mist, at least for the book and the 2007 movie. We will cover the TV series at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in the words of every Pacific Northwesterner, the mist will burn off.
It will eventually go away and the sun will come out and shine another day.
Yeah, and then who knows? Maybe even the mountain will be out.
Which one? St. Helens or Mount Hood?
Yeah.
On a good day, you can see them both up here.
Yeah.
When you're going over the
interstate. Oh, you can even see Adams. The days where you can see all three?
Oh, I didn't know what that last mountain was called. Now I know.
Yeah. Yeah. We love going over I-5 and seeing the cute shit.
Mm-hmm. The good shit.
Yeah, where when you look past the fentanyl and see the
see the nature in the background. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, well, that's it.
Yeah. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Okay, bye.
Bye. It's our whisper.